Seeing that the outsider was with someone, people returned to their business.
My friend, Aizaru said warmly, still in Mentish. I was just thinking of writing to you. What are you doing in Genura?
Due to various disagreeable circumstances, I have some respite from Orisima, Nicolai said in Sykanese. The honored governor of Cape Hisan decided to send me here to be placed under house arrest.
Whoever brought you here should not have abandoned you in the street. Did you come by palanquin?
Sadly.
Ah, those who carry them are often mischief makers, Aizaru grimaced. Please, come to my house before someone wonders why you are here. I will let the honored governor of Genura know what happened.
You are too kind. Nicolai followed Aizaru over a bridge into a much wider street that led straight to the main gate of Genura Castle. Musicians played in pools of shade, while vendors touted fresh clams and sea grapes. He had never thought to lay eyes upon the famous seasoned trees of Genura. Their branches formed a natural pavilion over the street. At present, they wore dazzling yellow for the summer. Aizaru lived in a modest house near the silk market, which backed onto one of the many canals that latticed Genura. He had been widowed for a decade, but his daughter had stayed with him so that they could pursue their passion for medicine together. Rain flowers frothed over the exterior wall, and the garden was redolent of mugwort and purple-leaved mint and other herbs. It was Perume who opened the door to them. A bobtail cat snaked around her ankles.
Nicolas!
Perume smiled before bowing. She favoured the same eyeglasses as her father, but the sun had tanned her skin to a deeper brown than his, and her hair, held back with a strip of cloth, was still black at the roots.
Please, come in. What an unexpected pleasure.
Nicolas bowed and returned. Please forgive me for disturbing you, Perume. This is unexpected for me, too.
We were your honored guests, Senorissima. You are always welcome.
She took one look at his travel-soiled clothes and chuckled. But you will need something else to wear.
I quite agree.
When they were inside, Aizaru sent his two servants to the well.
Rest for a while, he told Nicolas. You may have the sunquake after that journey. I will go at once to the White River Castle and ask to speak to the honored governor. Then we can eat.
Nicolas sighed with relief. That would be wonderful. When the servants had returned from the well and filled a tub, Nicolas divested himself of his garments and laved away the mud and sweat. The cold water was bliss. Damned if he was ever travelling in a palanquin again. They could drag him back to Orisima. Reinvigorated, he donned the summer robe the servants had left in the guest room. A cup of tea steamed on the balcony. He sat drinking it in the shade, watching boats glide past on the canal. After years of imprisonment, Orisima had never seemed farther away.
Learned Dr. Roos?
He stirred from a contented doze. One of the servants had appeared on the balcony.
The learned Dr. Moyaka is back, she said. He requests your presence.
Thank you. Downstairs, Aizaru awaited him.
Nicolas. There was a hint of mischief in his smile. I spoke to the honored governor. She has agreed to my request that you remain with Perume and myself while you are in the city.
Oh, Aizaru. Perhaps it was the heat or his exhaustion, but the good news almost brought Nicolas to tears. Are you quite sure it is no trouble?
Of course not. Aizaru ushered him into the next room. Come now, you must be famished.
The servants had done what they could to keep the heat out. Every door had been opened, screens blocked sunlight, and bowls of ice waited on the table. Nicolas knelt with Perume and Aizaru, and they dined on marbled beef and salt-pickled vegetables and sweet fish and sea lettuce and little cups of toasted seaweed, each bursting with roe. While they ate, they spoke of what they had all been doing since they had last met. It had been a long time since Nicolas had been allowed the pleasure of a conversation with like-minded people. Aizaru was still running his medical practice, which now offered both Sykanese and Mentish remedies for ailments. Perume, meanwhile, was working on a herbal concoction that brought on a deep sleep, allowing a surgeon to remove carnosities from the body without causing pain.
I call it blossom sleep, she said, as the final ingredient was a flower from the South Mountains.
She trekked for days to find that flower in the spring, Aizaru said, with a proud smile at his daughter.
It sounds revolutionary, Nicolas said,
stunned. You could use it to study the interior of living bodies. In Mentendon, all we can do is cut open corpses. His heart thumped. Perume, you must publish these findings. Think of how anatomy would change.
I would, she said, with a wary smile. But there is one problem. Nicolas, fire cloud.
Fire cloud? A restricted substance. Alchemists make it from the bile of fire breathers, Izaru explained. The bile is smuggled into the east by southern pirates, treated in some way, then stuffed into a ceramic orb with a dab of gunpowder. When the wick is lit, the orb explodes and releases a smoke as black and thick as tar. If a dragon breathes it in, it falls asleep for many days. The pirates can then sell its body parts.
An evil practice, Perume said.
Nicolas shook his head. What has that to do with blossom sleep?
If the authorities believe my creation might be used for similar means, they will stop my research. They may even close down our practice.
Nicolas was speechless. It is very sad, Izaru said heavily. Tell us, Nicolas, are any Psychanese medical documents translated in Mentendon? Perhaps Perume could publish her findings there. Nicolas sighed. Unless things have changed dramatically in the years I have been away, I doubt it. Pamphlets change hands in some circles, but they were not approved by the crown. Virtudom does not hold with heresy or with knowledge of heretics. Perume shook her head. As Nicolas helped himself to some prawns, a young man appeared in the doorway, dewy from the heat.
Learned Dr. Roos, he bowed, panting. I come from the honored governor of Genura.
Nicolas braced himself. She must have changed her mind about letting him stay here.
She asks me to inform you, the servant said, that you will be expected at Genura Castle for an audience when it pleases the all-honored warlord.
Nicolas raised his eyebrows.
The all-honored warlord wishes to see me. Are you quite sure?
Yes.
The servant bowed out of the room.
So you will be received at court?
Izaru looked amused.
Be ready. They say it is like a reef of sea flowers. Beautiful, but everything you touch will sting.
I can hardly wait, Nicolas said, but his brow knitted. I wonder why he wants to see me.
The all-honored warlord likes to hear from the Mentish settlers. Sometimes he will ask to hear a song or a story from your country. Or he may wish to know what sort of work you are doing, Izaru said. It will be nothing to worry about, Nicolas, truly.
And until then, you are free, Perume pointed out, eyes twinkling. Let us show you our city while you are out of Orisiba. We could visit the theater, speak about medicine, see the dragons in flight, anything you have wanted to do since you arrived.
Nicolas could have wept with gratitude.
Truly, my friends, he said, I should like nothing better.
Chapter 19. West. Loth followed the Donmata Morosa through yet another passageway. Torchlight baked his eyes as he edged between the sweating walls. Days after he had last heard from her, she had told him to meet her again in a darkened solar. Now they were in a warren of tunnels behind the walls, where a clever system of copper pipes conducted water from the hot springs to the bedchambers. At the end of the passage was a spiralling stair. The Donmata began to ascend.
Where are you taking me? Loth said, stiffly.
We are going to meet the one who plotted the murder of Queen Rosarian.
His hand grew clammy on the torch.
I am sorry, incidentally, she said, for making you dance with Priessa. It was the only way to get you the message.
Could she not have given it to me in the coach? He muttered.
No. She was searched before she left the palace, and the coach driver was a spy, there to ensure she could not flee. No one is permitted to leave Cascaro for long.
The Donmata detached a key from her girdle. When Loth followed her through the door she unlocked, he coughed on the dust in the chamber beyond, where the only light stemmed from his torch. The furniture stank of sickness and decay, with a mordant edge of vinegar. The Donmata lifted her veil and draped it over a chair. Loth followed her towards a four-poster bed, hardly breathing for fear, and held up his torch. A blindfolded figure sat in the bed. Loth made out waxen skin, charcoal lips, and chestnut hair
that straggled to the collar of a crimson bedgown. Chains bound two emaciated arms. Red lines branched down them, following the tracery of his veins.
"What is this?" Loth murmured. "This is the killer."
The Don Marta folded her arms. Her jaw was a steady line, her eyes bereft of emotion.
"Lord Arteloth," she said, "I present to you my lord father, Sigoso III of the House of Vitalda, flesh king of the draconic kingdom of Iskallen, or what is left of him."
Loth looked back at the man in disbelief. Even before the betrayal of Iskallen, he had not seen King Sigoso, but in his portraits he had always looked hale and handsome, if cold, with the amber eyes of the Vitalda. Sabran had invited him to court several times, but he had always preferred to send representatives.
"A flesh king rules as the puppet of a worm, a title Fyadel hopes to bestow on every ruler in the world."
The Don Marta walked around the bed.
"Father has a rare form of the draconic plague. It allows Fyadel to commune with him somehow, to see and hear into the palace."
"You mean at this very moment? Peace."
"I put a sedative in his evening drink," she said. "I cannot do it often, or Fyadel becomes suspicious, but it keeps the worm from using him for a short while."
At the sound of her voice, Sigoso stirred.
"I had no idea worms could do such a thing,"
Loth swallowed.
"Control a body."
"When High Westerns die, the fire goes out in the wyverns who serve them, and in the progeny those wyverns sired. Perhaps this is a similar kind of connection."
"How long has he been like this?"
2 years.
"He had fallen ill when Iskallen had betrayed virtudom. How did he become this?"
"First, you must hear the truth," the Don Marta said. "My father remembers enough to tell you."
"Morosa," Sigoso croaked. "Morosa."
Loth flinched at his voice. It was as if a knot of rattlesnakes were nesting in his throat.
"Where are you, daughter?"
the king asked very softly.
"Must I come and find you?"
Expressionless, the Don Marta turned to him and set about removing the blindfold. Though she wore velvet gloves that covered her to the elbow, Loth could not breathe while she was so close to her father, fearing Sigoso might bite through the velvet or make a grab for her face. When the blindfold came away, Sigoso bared his teeth. His eyes were no longer topaz, but grey all the way through, hollows of cold ash.
"I hope you slept well, father,"
the Don Marta said in Inish.
"I dreamed of a clock tower and a woman with a fire within her. I dreamed she was my enemy."
King Sigoso stared at Loth, flexing his arms in their chains.
"Who is this?"
"This is Lord Arteloth Beck of Goldenbirch. He is our new ambassador from Innis."
The Don Marta forced a smile.
"I wondered if you would care to tell him how Queen Rosarian died."
Sigoso breathed like a bellows. His gaze darted between them, a hunter sizing up two morsels.
"I ended Rosarian."
The way he spoke that name, rolling it about on his tongue like a convict, gave Loth a chill.
"Why?"
the Don Marta said.
"That venereal slut refused my hand, the hand of royalty,"
Sigoso spat out. The cords in his neck strained.
"She would rather whore herself for pirates and lordlings than unite with the blood of the House of Vitalda."
Spittle ran from his mouth.
"Daughter, I am burning."
With a glance at Loth, the Don Marta went to his nightstand, where a cloth lay beside a bowl of water. She soaked the cloth and set it on his brow.
"I had her a gown made," Sigoso continued. "A gown of such beauty that a vain harlot like a Rosarian could never resist it. I had it laced with basilisk venom I bought from a merchant prince, and I sent it to Innis to be hid among her garments."
Loth was shivering.
"Who hid it?"
he whispered.
"Who hid the gown?"
"He will not speak to anyone but me," the Don Marta murmured.
"Father, who hid the gown?"
"A friend in the palace."
"In the palace?"
Loth echoed. "By the saint, who?"
The Don Marta repeated his question. Sagoso chuckled, but it splintered into a cough.
The cupbearer, he said.
Loth stared. The position of cupbearer had been defunct for centuries. The gown would have been planted in the privy wardrobe. The mistress of the robes at the time had been Lady Arbella Glen, and she would never have hurt her queen.
I hope, Sagoso said, that there was some of the strumpet left to bury. Basilisk venom is so strong, he hacked up a laugh. Even bone yields before its bite.
At this, Loth drew his baselard.
Forgive my lord father, the Don Marta gazed soullessly at the Flesh King. I would say that he is not himself, but I think he is as much himself as he has ever been.
Disgusted, Loth took a step towards the bed. The Knight of Courage turns his back to you, Sagoso Vitalda, he said, voice quaking. Her hand was hers to give to whomever she desired. Damn you to the womb of fire! Sagoso smiled.
I am there, he said, and it is paradise.
The grey in his eyes flickered. Red flecks ignited inside them, like embers.
Fyadel!
The Don Marta snatched a cup from the nightstand.
Father, drink this. It will ease the pain.
She pressed it to his lips. Never taking his gaze from Loth, Sagoso drank what was inside. Overcome by what he had heard, Loth let the Don Marta usher him out. His mother, Lady Ansbeck, had been with the Queen Mother when she died. Now he understood why neither she nor Sabran had ever been able to utter a word to him about the day Rosarian had been laced into that lovely gown. Why Lady Arbella Glen, who had loved her like her own child, had never uttered a word again. Loth sank onto the steps. As he shook, he became aware of the Don Marta behind him.
"Why did you have me listen to him?" he asked. "Why not just tell me?"
"So that you could see and hear the truth," she said, "and deliver it to Sabran. And so that you would believe it and not leave thinking that a mystery still lies in Escalin."
The Don Marta sat on the step behind his, so their heads were level. She placed a silk-wrapped bundle into her lap.
"Can he hear us?" Loth asked her.
"No, he sleeps again." She sounded tired.
"I pray Fyadel will not realize that I stopped him. He may think Father is dying, which I think he is." Her chin lifted. "I have no doubt the worm intends for me to replace him. His mannequin to be controlled."
"Does Fyadel not take issue with your keeping the king like this, chained in a dark room?"
"Fyadel understands that my father does not look kingly in his present state, his body rotting even as it continues to draw breath,"
the Don Marta said dryly.
"But I must lead him from his rooms when ordered, so our lord and master can see into the palace whenever he desires, so he can issue orders to the Privy Council, so he can ensure we are not mounting a rebellion, so he can stop us calling for aid."
"If you killed your father, Fyadel would know," Loth realized, "and punish you."
"The last time I defied him, he had one of my ladies put on the gate of Nyunda."
Her face tightened.
"I had to watch as his cockatrices pecked her to shreds."
They were quiet and still for a time.
"Queen Rosarian died 14 years ago," Loth stated.
"Then Sagoso did not do it under draconic control."
"Not all evil comes from worms."
The Don Marta turned to face him on the stair, so her back was against the wall.
"I do not remember a great deal about my father from my childhood. Just his cold gaze," she murmured. "When I was 16, my mother came to my bedchamber in the middle of the night. Their marriage had always been strained, but now she looked afraid and angry. She said we were going to join her brother, King Jantar in Rauka. We dressed as servants and stole through the palace. Of course, the guards stopped us, confined us both to our bedchambers, and forbade us from speaking. I have never cried so hard in my life. Mama bribed a guard to pass me a letter, telling me to remain strong."
She touched the pendant at her throat, set with emeralds.
"A week later, Father came to inform me of her death. He told the court that she took her own life, shamed by her attempt to abandon the king.
But I know otherwise. She would never have left me alone with him.
I am sorry, Loth said. Not as sorry as I am.
Disgust tightened her face.
Iskallen does not deserve this, but my father does. He deserves to look as corrupt on the outside as he always was within.
Sahar Tamargum and Rosarion Barethnet, both dead by the hand of the same king, all while Innes had considered him a friend in Virtudom.
I wanted to tell Sabran the truth. I wanted to call for aid, for troops. But this palace is a dungeon. The Privy Council has fallen utterly to Fyodel, too afraid to anger him. They have families in the city who would die if we stoked his wrath.
Loth lifted his sleeve to his face to blot the sweat.
Sabran was my friend. Prince Obrecht was my betrothed for a long while, the Don Marta reminded him. I know they must think ill of me now.
Guilt pricked at Loth. Forgive us, he murmured. We should not all have assumed you would never have known Fyodel was awake, or that we were under his wing. Tell me how Cascaro fell. Help me understand. The Don Marta breathed out through her nose.
2 years ago, there was a quake in the Spindles, she said. Fyodel had awakened in a chamber in Mount Fruma, where he had gone to sleep after the grief of ages. We were on his doorstep, ripe for the seizing. The lavender fields burned first. Black smoke choked the evening sky. She shook her head. It all happened so quickly. Wyverns had surrounded Cascaro before the city guards could reach the old defences. Fyodel appeared for the first time in centuries. He said he would set us all afire if my father did not come to him to pay tribute.
And did he?
He sent a decoy at first, but Fyodel sensed the deception. He burned the man alive, and my father was forced to emerge, she said. Fyodel took him into the mountains. For the rest of that night, Cascaro descended into chaos. People thought a second grief of ages had begun, which, in a way, it had.
A terrible sadness darkened her eyes. Panic reigned. Thousands tried to flee, but the only way out is through the gate of Niunda. And the wyverns guarded it. Her mouth pinched. Father returned at dawn. The people saw that their king was alive and unharmed, and did not know what to think. He told them that they would be the first to witness the rise of the draconic world, if they obeyed. Behind the walls of this palace, Father ordered his privy council to announce our allegiance to the Nameless One. They sent word to every nation, too craven to challenge him, too craven when he ordered our defences be torn down, too craven when he burned down the aviary and every bird left in it. I tried to organise a counterstroke to no avail. I could do no more without endangering my life.
But the rest of the country did not know the truth, Loth said.
Cascaro became a fortress that night. No one could get word out.
Her head dropped back against the wall.
Worms are weak when they first stir.
For a year, Fyodel remained under Mount Fruma, regaining his strength. I watched as he used my father to turn my country into the base of his power. I watched him destroy the six virtues. I watched plague awaken and spread among my people, and my home became my prison.
That was when Arteloth Beck did exactly what Gion Harlow had warned him not to do. He took Marosa Vitalda by the hand. She wore velvet gloves. It was still a risk, and yet he did it without a second thought.
You are the very embodiment of courage, he told her, and your friends in Virtudom have failed you.
The Don Marta looked at their hands with a notch in her brow. Loth wondered when it was that she had last been touched.
Tell me how I can help you, he said.
Slowly, she placed her other hand over his.
You can go back into that bedchamber, she said, lifting her gaze to his, and lay your uncovered hands upon my father.
It took him a moment to understand.
You want me to afflict myself?
I will explain, she said. But if you do it, I offer you a chance to escape Cascaro in return.
You said it was a fortress.
My mother knew one way out.
She set a hand on the bundle in her lap.
I want you to journey across the spindles and deliver this to Chasar Ak Ispat, the Ursiri ambassador. You must entrust it only to him.
The man who had raised Eerd and who had presented her to the court 8 years ago. The Don Marta unwrapped the silk. Inside was an iron box engraved with symbols.
In the spring, a woman was captured near Perunta, trying to find a ship that would take her on to Lassia. The torturers had her for days, but she never spoke. When my father set eyes on the red cloak she had with her, Fyadel was enraged. He ordered that she must spend her last hours in agony.
Loth was not sure if he could stand to hear this.
That night, I sought her out. The Don Marta skimmed her fingers over the box. I thought they had torn her tongue out at first, but when I gave her wine, she told me her name was Jondu. She told me that if I valued human life, I would get the objects she had been carrying to Chasar Uk Ispad. She paused. I killed Jondu myself. Told Fyadel she had died of her wounds. Better that than the gate. The box that had been taken from Jondu was locked. No one could open it, and eventually they lost interest. It was easy for me to steal it. I am sure that it is vital in our fight, and that Ambassador Uk Ispad will know more.
She traced the patterns on its lid.
He is most likely in Rumalabar. To reach the Azir and avoid the guarded borders, you must cross the spindles. The safest way to do that without harm from the draconic creatures that now live there is to become afflicted, so that when they smell you, they will not attack. She continued. Jondu swore the ambassador knows a cure for the plague. If you reach him in time, you may live to tell the tale.
Loth understood then.
Yes, Emprince Wilston to do this, he said, or tried. I did everything the same. I showed him my father and had him hear from his own lips how Rosarian died. And then I gave him the box. But Finch had been waiting for his opportunity to flee and to return to his daughter with the news of this place. She said, he assured me he had given himself the plague. When I realized he had not, I went after him with all haste. He had abandoned the box in the secret tunnel that leads to the mountains. He clearly never meant to honor my request, but I can hardly blame him for thinking he could get back to Sabran.
Where is he now? Loth asked, quietly.
I found him not far from the end of the tunnel, she said. It was an amphitheatre.
Loth rested his brow against his clasped hands. Amphitheatres were vicious, draconic creatures without limbs. They had strong jaws and were said to shake their prey like poppets until they were too weak to run.
I would have retrieved the remains, but I was attacked the moment I ventured too close. I said the necessary prayers.
Thank you.
Despite appearances, I am still faithful to the saint, and he needs us now, Lord Arteloth.
The Don Marta placed a hand on his forearm.
Will you do as I ask?
He swallowed.
What of Lord Kitson? He can remain here, and I will watch over him. Or he can go with you, but he must be afflicted too.
Even the Knight of Fellowship would not expect Kit to do this for him. He had already done too much.
Will Fyadel see through me? Loth asked.
No.
You will have the unusual kind of plague, she said. I have tested the theory.
He elected not to ask how.
Surely there are others in the palace who are loyal to the saint, he said. Why not send one of your own servants?
I trust only Priessa, and her disappearance would raise alarm. I would go myself, but I cannot leave my people without a sane Vatalda. Even if I am powerless to save them, I must stay and do what I can to undermine Fyadel.
He had misjudged the Don Marta Morosa. She was a true woman of virtudom, imprisoned in the shell of a home she must once have loved.
It is too late for me, my lord, she said, but not for virtudom. What has happened here in Iskallen must not be allowed to happen elsewhere.
Loth looked away from those fire opal eyes to the patron brooch on his doublet. Two hands joined in affinity, the self-same twine of fingers that graced the love-knot ring.
If the Knight of Fellowship were here, Loth knew what she would do.
If you consent, the Don Marta said, I would take you back to the Flesh King
and you will lay your hands on him. Then I will show you the way out of Escalin. She rose. If you refuse, I advise you to prepare yourself for a long life in Cascaro, Lord Arteloth Beck.
Chapter 20. East. While the other Sea Guardians celebrated the end of the trials in the banquet hall, Tane lay exhausted in her quarters. She had not emerged since her fight with Teresa. A surgeon had cleaned and stitched her shoulder, but moving drained her, and the throb was ceaseless. Tomorrow, she would find out if she was to ride. She gnawed the nail in her little finger until she tasted blood. If only for something less painful to do with her hands, she found her copy of Recollections of the Great Sorrow. The book had been a gift from one of her teachers for her 15th birthday. It had been some time since she had opened it, but its illustrations would distract her. Close to the 12th hour, when the song of the tree crickets was swelling outside, she was still awake, reading. One image portrayed a Cycanese woman with the red sickness. Her hands and eyes were crimson. On another page were the fire breathers. Their bat wings had frightened Tane when she was 15, and they still gave her a chill. The next image showed the people of Cape Hissan, standing on the coast, watching a great battle. Dragons twisted and thrashed among the waves, their jaws snapped at the demons as they rained fire upon Psyche. The final image showed the comet that had come on the last night of the Great Sorrow, Quirikhi's lantern, weeping meteors into the sea. The winged demons fled from it, while the dragons of Psyche rose from the waves, painted in coin-bright silvers and blues. A knock interrupted her reflections. Tane shifted painfully to her feet. When she slid open the door, she found Onren, clad in a dark green robe, hair bedecked with salt flowers. She was holding a tray.
"I bought supper," she said.
Tane stood aside.
"Come in."
She returned to her bedding. Her candles had burned low, stretching every shadow. Onren set the tray down, revealing a small feast. Tender cuts of sea bream, bean curd rolled in roe, and salt-pickled kelp in a fragrant broth, as well as a jar of spiced wine and a cup.
"The honored sea general let us taste his famous sea-aged wine," Onren said with a brief smile.
"I would have saved you some, but it ran out almost as quickly as it arrived. This is a touch less special," she poured from the jar, "but it might dampen your pain."
"Thank you," Tane said. "It was kind of you to think of me, but I never had a taste for wine. You have it."
"The trials are over, Tane. You can let go."
"But I suppose I could use it."
Onren knelt on the mats.
"We missed you at the banquet hall."
"I was tired."
"I thought you might say that. Not to insult you, but you look as if you haven't slept in years. And you've earned a rest."
She picked up the cup.
"You did well against Terusa. Perhaps the bastards finally realized that he is not so high above the peasants he despises."
"We are not peasants now," Tane studied her.
"You look worried."
"I think I lost the chance to ride today.
Kanpuru fights as well as he..."
She sipped the wine.
"Well..."
So she had fought Kanpuru. Tane had been taken to the surgeon before she could see the other trials.
"You excelled on all the other days," Tane reminded her. "The honored sea general would judge us fairly."
"How do you know? He is a rider."
"Terusa will be a rider tomorrow, yet he has spent years picking on those of us who came from peasant stock. I heard he beat a servant once for not bowing low enough. Either of us would have been exiled from the houses of learning for behaving that way, but blood still holds power."
"You do not know he will be a rider just because of that. I wager you all I own that he will."
Silence fell. Tane picked at the bean curd.
"I was scolded once, when I was 16, for gambling in the city," Onwen said, "because it was disreputable. I was barred from lessons and told I would have to earn back my place in the East House. I was scrubbing the outhouses for the rest of the season. Meanwhile, Teruso can almost murder a servant and have a sword in his hand a few days later."
"Our learned teachers had their reasons. They understand the true meaning of justice. Their reason was that he is the grandson of a rider and I am not. And that will be their reason tomorrow if I am cast off in favor of him. That will not be the reason."
Tane bit out. It had leapt from her tongue before she could catch it, like a slippery fish eluding her grasp. Onren raised her eyebrows. The silence hung, an unstruck bell,
as Tane wrestled with herself.
Come, Tane, speak your mind.
Onren raised a cautious smile. We are friends, after all. It was too late now to take it back. The trials, the outsider, her exhaustion and guilt, all of it came together violently like bubbles in boiling water, and Tane could no longer hold it in. You seem to think that if you are not made a rider tomorrow, it will be through no fault of yours, she heard herself say. I have worked every day and night during our time here. You, in the meantime, have shown no respect. You arrive late to your trials, in front of the Medushi. You spend nights in taverns when you ought to be practicing, then wonder why you fight poorly against your opponent. Perhaps that will be the reason you do not become a rider.
Onren was no longer smiling. So, she said curtly, you think I don't deserve it? Because I went to the tavern? She paused. Or is it because I went to the tavern and still outperformed you in the knife trial?
Tane stiffened. Your eyes were bloodshot that morning. They still are. You stayed up all night practicing. Of course I did. And you resent me because I didn't.
Onren shook her head. Balance is necessary in all things, Tane. It does not equate to disrespect. This position is the chance of a lifetime and not to be squandered.
I know that, Tane said. Her tone clipped. I only hope that you do, too.
At this, Onren smiled thinly, but Tane glimpsed the hurt in her eyes.
Well, she said, rising. In that case, I had better leave you. I have no wish to drag you down with me.
As quickly as the anger had brimmed inside Tane, it cooled. She sat very still, her hands pressed on the bedding, trying to swallow the tang of shame. Finally, she rose and bowed.
I apologize, Honorable Onren, she murmured. I should not have said any of that. It was inexcusable.
After a pause, Onren softened.
Forgiven. Truly, she sighed. I have been worried about you.
Tane kept her gaze down. You have always worked hard, but throughout these trials, it seems to me as if you have been punishing yourself, Tane. Why?
When she spoke like that, it was like having Sousa again. A kind face and an open mind. Just for a moment, Tane was tempted to tell Onren everything. Perhaps she would understand.
No, she said at last. I have only been afraid and tired.
She sank back onto the bedding. I will be better tomorrow, when I know my fate. Onren laughed at that.
Oh, Tane, you make it sound as if the jailhouse is the alternative.
Tane flinched, but managed to smile. I will leave you. We both need rest. Onren drained the cup.
Good night, Tane.
Good night. As soon as Onren was gone, Tane quenched the oil lamp and crawled under her bedding. Exhaustion and pain engulfed her at last, and she plunged into a dreamless sleep. When she woke, the light was golden. For a moment, she could not understand why the room was so bright. It seemed as if it had been dark for an eternity. She slid open the window. The sun gleamed on the rooftops of Ginura, even as the rain kept sheeting. A sun shower. A good omen. The servants would come soon with her new uniform. If the dragon on the back of the surcoat was silver, she would remain a sea guardian and serve as a leader in the navy. If it was gold, she was God-chosen. She paced the room and lit the incense in the shrine for one last prayer. She asked forgiveness for her impoliteness towards Onren, and again for what she had done on the night before the ceremony. If the great Quirky would only absolve her, she would prove her devotion for the rest of her life. The servants came as afternoon ended. Tane waited, eyes closed, before she turned to face them. The tunic was water silk, blue as sapphires, and on the back of the surcoat was the dragon emblem, embroidered in gold thread. Her new attendant skinned her hair into a military style. The scar on her cheek looked more prominent, and her shoulder ached, but her eyes were bright as fresh ink. As the sun took its leave, she emerged from her palanquin and stepped onto the pale sand of Ginura Bay. The choosing always took place at the end of the day, for her old life ended here. She wore new leather boots with a thick heel, the better to grip the stirrups of a saddle. A night rainbow burned against the smoky purple of the sky, daubed across the horizon in intensities of red. People were gathering on the cliffs to stare at this peculiar sign from the Great Quirky. and to watch the 12 new dragon riders walk towards the water. Teresa was among them. So were all of the other relatives of dragon riders. Tane fell into step beside Onren, who smiled at her. She had earned a place in Clan Medushi. The last time Tane had been on a beach, the stranger had stepped from the dark like a curse. Yet the tides within her, which had pushed her towards this day from the cradle, were strangely calm and still. 10 Cycanese dragons waited in the sea, lithe and beautiful. The sun and the rainbow lit the waves that lapped against their bodies. The 2 Lucastrine warriors, it seemed, had yet to arrive. When he was called, Kanpuru bowed to the sea general, who lifted a string of dancing pearls around his neck. He handed Kanpuru a helm and a padded saddle. Next, the sea general bestowed on him a mask to keep the elements off his face, and a sword quenched with salt water, its scabbard inlaid with mother-of-pearl, made by the finest bladesmith in Psyche. Kanpuru passed the cords of the helm around his neck, then hefted the saddle under his arm and strode into the water. Once he was up to his waist, he held out his right hand, palm turned upwards. A blue, grey dragon extended her neck and considered him with eyes like full moons. When she dipped her head farther, Kanpuru hooked his fingers into her mane and clambered onto her, mindful of her spines. No sooner were he in the saddle in place than his dragon let out a haunting call and plunged into the sea, drenching everyone on the beach. Onren approached the shore next, cheeks full of her smile. She had only held out her hand for a moment before the largest of the dragons, a hulking Cycanese with a black mane, his scales like beaten silver, came gliding towards the beach. Onren tensed at first, but once she had made contact, she relaxed and climbed his neck like a ladder.
"The Honorable Medushi Tane," the sea general called. "Step forward."
Onren lowered her mask over her face. The dragon lowered his head and swam away. Tane bowed to the sea general and let him lock the pearls at the base of her neck, the sign that she was God-chosen. She took the helmet and the saddle, and finally the sword in its scabbard. It already felt like part of her arm. She fastened it into her sash and waded into the sea. As warm salt water swilled around her calves, her breath came short. She reached out a hand, head down, eyes shut. Her hand was steady, but the rest of her was quaking. Cold scale brushed her fingers. She dared not look. She must. When she did, 2 eyes as bright as fireworks stared back from the face of a Lucastrine dragon. Chapter 21. West. Loth left his rooms in the Palace of Salvation for the last time in the dead of night. The draconic plague was inside him. One touch to the brow of the Flesh King, a prickle in his hand, and an hourglass had turned over in his mind. Soon enough, the fine grains of his sanity would begin to course between his fingers. Slung over his shoulder was a leather sack, filled with supplies for the journey through the mountains. His base-laden sword were at his side, concealed beneath a winter cloak. Kit followed him down the winding stairs.
"I do hope this is a good idea, Arteloth," he said.
"It is the opposite of a good idea."
"Piracy was the better option, undeniably."
They were entering the bowels of Cascaro. The Don Marta Morosa had told him how to access a hidden stair from the Privy Sanctuary, which tapered as they descended. Loth dried the cold sweat from his brow. He had pleaded with Kit to stay behind, but his friend had insisted on coming with him. An eternity passed before their boots hit the flat ground. Loth held his torch up. The Don Marta Morosa was waiting at the foot of the stair, her face cast into a shadow by her hood. She stood before a great crack in the wall.
"What is this place?" Loth asked.
"A forgotten escape route, for use in sieges, I suppose," she said. "It was how Mama and I meant to flee."
"Why did you not use it to get word out?"
"I tried." She lowered her hood.
"Lord Kitson, are you now afflicted?"
Kit bowed.
"Yes, Radiance, I believe I am sufficiently plague-ridden."
"Good." Her gaze snapped back to Loth.
"I sent one of my ladies. That was before I knew how many draconic creatures were in the mountains."
The inference was clear. The Don Marta reached behind her and held out matching wooden staffs, each capped with a hook. "Ice staves. They will help you find your balance." They took them. To Loth, she handed another sack,
heavy with the iron box. I bid you not abandon this task I have set for you, Lord Arteloth. Her eyes were jewel-like in the firelight. I trust that you will do this for me, and for virtuedom. With these words, she stood aside. We will send help, Loth spoke quietly. Keep your father alive for as long as you can. If he dies, hide yourself from Fyodel. When this task is done, we will tell the sovereigns of virtuedom what has happened here. You will not die alone in this place. At last, the Donmata Morosa smiled, just a little, as if she had forgotten how.
You have a kind heart, Lord Arteloth, she said. If you do get back to Innis, give Sabran and Albrecht my regards.
I will, he bowed to her. Goodbye, your radiance. Goodbye, my lord. Their gazes held for a song of heartbeats. Loth dipped his head once more and stepped into the passage.
May the Knight of Courage bring you cheer in these dark hours, Kit said to Morosa. And you, Lord Kitson.
Her footsteps echoed as she left. Loth felt a sudden regret that they could not take her with them. Morosa Vertalda, Donmata of Iskallen, imprisoned in her tower. The passageway was unspeakably dark. A breeze drew Loth on like a beckoning hand. He snared his boot on the uneven ground at once, almost robbing himself of an eye with his torch. They were surrounded by the glimmer of volcanic glass and the porous swirl of pumice. The glass mirrored the light of his torch, casting 100 different reflections. They walked for what seemed like hours, sometimes turning a corner, but otherwise moving in a straight line. Their staves tapped out a rhythm. Once Kit coughed, and Loth tensed.
Hush, he said. I would rather not wake whatever dwells down here.
A man must cough when need be, and nothing dwells down here. Tell me these walls don't look as if a basilisk carved them.
Oh, stop being such a doom-singer. Think of this as another adventure.
I never wanted an adventure, Loth said warily, not even one. At this moment, I want to be at Briar House with a cup of mulled wine, preparing to walk my queen to the altar. And I should like to be waking up beside Kate Withy, but alas, we cannot have everything. Loth smiled.
I'm glad you're here, Kit.
I should think so, Kit said, his eyes shining. This place made Loth think of the Nameless One, and how he had torn through the earth until he found his way into the world above. His mother had often told him the story when he was a child, using different voices to frighten him and make him laugh. He took another step. The ground underfoot gave a hollow rumble like the belly of a giant. Loth stopped dead, clutching the torch. Its flame guttered as another cold wind feathered through the tunnel.
Is it a quake?
Kit murmured. When Loth did not reply, his voice grew tense.
Loth, is it a quake?
Hush, I don't know. Another rumble came, louder this time, and the earth seemed to tilt. Loth lost his footing. No sooner had he caught himself than a terrific shuddering began, first soft like a shiver of fear, then more and more violent, until his teeth rattled in their sockets.
It's a quake, he shouted. Run! Kit, run, man, run!
The iron box pounded against his back. They barreled through the darkness, desperately searching for any glint of daylight ahead. It was as if the very mantle of the earth was convulsing.
Loth! Kit, his voice shot through with terror. The torch! My torch is out!
Loth turned on his heel, winded, and thrust out his torch. His friend had fallen far behind.
Kit! He ran back. On your feet, man! Hurry! Follow my voice!
A creak, like weak ice underfoot. Small rocks like gravel peppering his back. He threw his hands over his head as the roof of the tunnel came pouring down. For a long time, he expected to die. The Knight of Courage fled from him, and he whimpered like a child. The darkness blinded him. Rock smashed, glass shattered and rang. He coughed on foul-tasting dust. And then, just like that, it stopped.
Kit! Loth bellowed. Kit!
Panting, he reached for his torch, still lit, miraculously, and swung it towards the place he had heard Kit calling out to him. Rock and volcanic glass filled the tunnel.
Kitson!
He could not be dead. He must not be dead. Loth shoved at the wall of debris with all his might, threw his shoulder against it time and again, struck at it with the ice staff and pounded his fists bloody. When at last it gave way, he reached into the rubble
and hauled at the rocks with his bare hands, and the air down here was like half-set honey, sticky in his throat. His fingers closed around a limp hand. He shoved more glass aside, his muscles straining with the effort. And there, at last, was Kit. There were the eyes Loth knew, their laughter gone, the mouth, so quick to smile, that would never smile again. There was the tablet about his neck, twin to the one he had given Loth at their last feast of fellowship. The rest of him was out of sight. All Loth could see was the blood that seeped between the rocks. A desperate sob heaved out of him. His cheeks were wet with sweat and tears. His knuckles bled, and his mouth tasted of iron.
"Forgive me," he said thickly. "Forgive me, Kixon Glade."
Chapter 22. West. The marriage of Sebran the Ninth and Aubrecht the Second took place as summer turned to autumn. It was customary for the vows to be taken at midnight, during the new moon, for it was in the darkest hours that companionship was needed most. And a dark hour it was. Never in Breithnet history had a marriage come so soon after a burial. The great sanctuary of Briar House, like most sanctuaries, was round, modelled on the shields used by the early knights of Innes. After the grief of ages, when its roof had caved in, Rosarian II had ordered red stained glass windows be set into the arches in memory of those whose blood had been spilled. Over the centuries, three scoundrel trees had broken through the floor and pleached their branches over the walkway. Their leaves already burned with gold and umber. 600 people had gathered beneath them for the ceremony, including the most virtuous order of sanctarians. When the Queen of Innes appeared at the south-facing doors, the witnesses fell silent. Her hair was brushed to an ebony gloss, threaded with white flowers. A partlet latticed her necklace. She wore a crown of filigrane gold, inlaid with rubies that caught the light of every candle. The choir began to sing, their voices fluting high and rich. Sebran took one step, then stopped. From her position among the candle-bearers, Eid watched the Queen as she stayed there, rooted to the spot. Roslane, her giver, pressed her arm.
"Sab," she whispered.
Sebran drew herself up. In the darkness of the sanctuary, few would be able to see the rigid set of her shoulders or the shiver that might have been put down to the chill. A moment later, she was on her way. Satan Combe observed her approach from where the Duke's spiritual and their family stood. The candlelight revealed the pinch of satisfaction at the corner of his mouth. He had sent Loth to his death for this night. Loth, who should be with Sebran. It was traditional in Innes for the closest friends of the betrothed to lead them into the state of companionship. Nearby, Igraine Crest was impenetrable. Eid supposed this was both a victory and a defeat for her. She wanted an heir, but not by this father. It was also proof that Sebran was no longer the grief-stricken girl who had needed so much guidance in her minority. The Red Prince entered on the other side of the sanctuary. His eldest sister was his giver. He wore a cloak to match his betrothed, lined with crimson silk and ermine, and a doublet with gold fastenings. Like Sebran, he wore gloves with ostentative cuffs, the better to draw the eye during the ceremony. A circlet of gilded silver declared his royalty. Sebran walked with poise towards him. Her wedding gown was something to behold, deep crimson, like cherry wine, and a black forepart, rich with goldwork and pearls. Her ladies, Eid included, were her inverse, their black gowns set off by red stomachers. The marriage party met on the boss of the sanctuary, beneath a gilded baldachin that stood on ornate columns. The witnesses formed a circle around it. Now Sebran was lit by the candles on the boss, close enough to Lee Evelyn for him to see her clearly. He swallowed. Sebran took Roslane by the hand, while Lee Evelyn locked fingers with his eldest sister, and the four of them knelt on hassocks. Everyone else fanned away. As she snuffed her candle, Eid spied Chazar in the crowd. The Archsanitarian of Innes was spindle-fingered, so pale that traceries of blue veins could be seen about his temples. The true sword was figured in silver on the front of his heregort. "Friends," he spoke into the silence, "we meet tonight
in this haven from the world, to bear witness to the union of these two souls in the sacred state of companionship. Like the damsel and the saint, they seek to meet in soul and in flesh for the preservation of virtudem. Companionship is a great service, for Innis itself was built on the love between Gallian, a knight of Inisca, and Cleolind, a heretic woman of Lassia.
Moments in, and someone had already called the mother a heretic. He had exchanged a brief look with Chassar across the aisle. After clearing his throat, the arch-centurion opened his silver-fronted prayer book and read the story of the Knight of Fellowship, who had been the first to join the Holy Retinue. He had only half listened. Her gaze was fixed to Sabran, who was perfectly still. Lievelin glanced at her. When the story was finished, Roslane and Ermuna, their duties as givers complete, stepped away from the royal couple. Roslane went to stand by her companion, Lord Calidore Stillwater, who drew her close. She never pulled her gaze from Sabran, who in turn watched her friend leave her under the baldachin with an all but stranger.
"Let us begin,"
the arch-centurion nodded to Lievelin. The High Prince removed the glove from his left hand and held it out.
"Sabran, the ninth of the House of Berethnet, Queen of Innis, your betrothed extends to you the hand of fellowship. Will you accept and be his faithful companion from this day to the end of days?"
Lievelin gave Sabran a smile that barely creased his eyes. The shadows made it hard to tell if she was smiling back as she took a love-knot ring from the arch-centurion. "Friend," she said. "I will." She paused, jaw tight, and Eid saw the slight rise of her breast. "Albrecht Lievelin," she continued, "I take you now as my companion." She slid the ring onto his forefinger. Gold, reserved for sovereigns. "My friend, my bedfellow, my constant partner in all things," pause, "I swear to love you with my soul, defend you with my sword, and give nobody else my favour. This I vow to you." The arch-centurion nodded again. Now it was Sabran who removed her left glove.
"Albrecht II, of the House of Lievelin, High Prince of the Free State of Mentendon," came the exhortation, "your betrothed extends to you the hand of fellowship. Will you accept and be her faithful companion from this day to the end of days?"
"Friend," Lievelin said, "I will." When he took Sabran's ring from the arch-centurion, her hand gave a barely visible quake. This was her last chance to withdraw from the marriage before it was legally binding. Eid glanced towards Roslane, whose lips were moving just a little, as if in encouragement or in prayer. Sabran looked up at Lievelin and, at last, gave him a subtle nod. He took her left hand, as gently as if it were a butterfly, and placed the ring. It gleamed on her finger. "Sabran Berethnet," he said, "I take you now as my companion, my friend, my bedfellow, my constant partner in all things. I swear to love you with my soul, defend you with my sword, and give nobody else my favour." He pressed her hand. "This I vow to you." There was a brief silence as their gazes locked. Then the arch-centurion opened his arms as if to embrace the witnesses, shattering the moment.
"I now pronounce these two souls joined in the holy state of companionship in the eyes of the saint," he called out, "and through him, all of virtudem."
Cheers erupted across the sanctuary. That sound of shared joy seemed loud enough to bring down the roof again. As she clapped, Eid took stock of the Duke's spiritual within her sight. Nelda Stillwater and Lemand Finch looked pleased. Cress stood like a scepter, her mouth a lipless stripe, but tapped her fingers on her palm in a game attempt at applause. Behind them, the Nighthawk was all smiles. Companions usually kissed once they were wed, but for royals, such a display was not seemly. Sabran instead took the arm Lievelin proffered, and they descended from the platform together. And Eid saw that, though her face was drawn, the Queen of Innis smiled for her people. Eid traded a glance with Margaret, who took a teary-eyed Lenora by the elbow. Like ghosts, the three of them walked away. In the royal bedchamber, they arrayed the bed and checked every nook for danger.
A cast bronze figurine of the Knight of Fellowship had been placed beneath the lead light. He had lit the candles on the mantelpiece, drew the curtains, and knelt to start a fire. The Arch Sanctarium